It is March of 1944, and speaking in Australia, MacArthur can say...
2 years ago, when I landed on your soil, I said to the people of the Philippines whence I came, I shall return. Tonight, I repeat those words. I shall return.
On October 20th, 1944, the general leads his avenging armies ashore at Leyte in the Philippines. One who was there speaks of it now, General Carlos Romulo.
That day is etched in my memory because it was a brush with history that General MacArthur, with his superb leadership, wrought. When we landed on the beach, he said to me as he shook my two hands, "Carlos, my boy, you are home." That word, home, thrilled me. I had been homeless for 3 years and a half, and I was back home. And that was because America did not let my people down. And that was because General MacArthur made good his promise, "I shall return."
February 3rd, 1945. Manila is free. The ordeal of internment that began with the surrender of Bataan and Corregidor is at its end. America has kept the soldier's faith. And back among his men, MacArthur can say, "I'm a little late, but we finally came." And on Corregidor, the road to redemption ends. The humiliation is purged.
I see that the old flagstaff still stands. Have your troops hoist the colors to its peak, and let no enemy ever haul them down.
The atomic bomb ends the war with Japan as abruptly as the attack on Pearl Harbor had started it. The people of Hiroshima do not know what has happened to them. Days pass before they learn that their tragedy marks the birth of the atomic age and the final unconditional surrender of Japan. America celebrates as America has never celebrated before. On September 2nd, 1945, Japanese government and military representatives board the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay for the signing of the official documents of surrender. Douglas MacArthur is designated to accept the surrender, a stern, grim-faced figure who, as much as any single American, has helped turn Japan's dreams of conquest into a nightmare of defeat.
It is my earnest hope, and indeed the hope of all mankind, that from this solemn occasion, a better world shall emerge out of the blood and carnage of the past. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
Thus, at 9:08 on this September morning, the great tragedy is ended. The great victory won. The holy mission completed. But Douglas MacArthur's work is not done. New triumphs and new tragedies lie ahead as the general speaks.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
The arrival of American forces in Tokyo and the appointment of Douglas MacArthur as Supreme Commander are the start of one of the strangest military occupations in history. An occupation that begins with the raising of the same flag that had flown over Washington on December 7th, 1941. The general's goal is to lead Japan out of almost 2,000 years of feudalism. He institutes an agricultural reform program that for the first time allows tenant farmers to purchase land from absentee lords and owners. As the months and years of occupation go on, MacArthur pursues a policy that, to the surprise of many, is slightly left of center. But democracy, as it is outlined to the Japanese people, seems to take hold. Free speech, free press, labor unions, these all give evidence of a nation's transformation. And on his birthday, MacArthur the Conqueror is serenaded as MacArthur the Savior. Communist troops stream out of North Korea in June 1950, and America again has need of soldier Douglas MacArthur as GIs are rushed to the front. Many of them will huddle in the mud of Korea for 3 years. Some will sleep here forever.
Those gallant men will remain often in my thoughts and in my prayers always.
As a pathetic river of refugees surges southward, other members of the United Nations join America in the effort to halt the communist aggression. U.S. troops, as in the dark early days of World War II, must endure defeat and retreat. And then MacArthur, named UN Commander-in-Chief, devises a bold and daring plan. An amphibious invasion of Incheon, far behind the enemy lines. Because of tides and terrain, many American military experts urge MacArthur to abandon the landing. The invasion has been called a masterpiece by military men around the world, including Britain's World War II Chief of Staff, Lord Allenbrooke, who speaks of it now.
I had written in my diaries, from everything that I saw of General MacArthur, I put him down as the greatest general of World War II. During the Korean War, I was again very interested in General MacArthur's strategy, and I thought that his Incheon landing was again one of those wonderful strokes in which he used his amphibious power and carried out an outflanking movement where a less able general would have fired straight ahead up the mainland of the island.
The Incheon invasion puts the North Korean invaders to rout, and General MacArthur sends the United Nations forces across the 38th parallel and toward the communist Chinese border. It is a move made with the full knowledge and approval of American and UN officials. But the advance brings criticism and concern. At Wake Island in October 1950, the central figures in the growing conflict, President Harry Truman and General Douglas MacArthur, meet for what is the first and will be the only time. The two men and their advisors confer privately for several hours in seeming harmony. Admirers of both are to say later that had they known each other better, they would probably have gotten along beautifully. But the opportunity never comes. And when so-called communist Chinese volunteers intervene in Korea, the general is attacked anew. He is to blame, his critics say, for not accurately forecasting Red China's intentions. As Americans once again retreat, MacArthur speaks out forcefully, uncompromisingly, for what he feels are the actions and decisions necessary to defeat the new enemy. The great controversy between general and president grows sharper as the war settles into a stalemate and snow-swept Korea becomes a modern Valley Forge. In April 1951, Truman relieves MacArthur.
I believe that we must try to limit the war to Korea for these vital reasons. To make sure that the precious lives of our fighting men are not wasted. To see that the security of our country and the free world is not needlessly jeopardized. And to prevent a third world war. A number of events have made it evident that General MacArthur did not agree with that policy. I have therefore considered it essential to relieve General MacArthur so that there would be no doubt or confusion as to the real purpose and aim of our policy. It is with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
Douglas MacArthur comes before Congress to make his defense. And in millions of homes, in offices and machine shops, in every nook and corner of America, a nation stands still and listens.
I stand on this rostrum with a sense of deep humility and great pride. Humility in the wake of those great American architects of our history who have stood here before me, pride in the reflection that this forum of legislative debate represents human liberty in the purest form yet devised. The issues are global and so interlocked that to consider the problems of one sector oblivious to those of another is but to court disaster for the whole. You cannot appease or otherwise surrender to communism in Asia without simultaneously undermining our efforts to halt its advance in Europe. Efforts have been made to distort my position. It has been said, in effect, that I was a warmonger. Nothing could be further from the truth. I know war as few other men now living know it, and nothing to me and nothing to me is more revolting. I have long advocated its complete abolition, as its very destructiveness on both friend and foe has rendered it useless as a means of settling international disputes. I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
America will not yield her heroes so easily. She cannot let Douglas MacArthur just fade away. She must, and she does, pour out her heart in thunderous tribute. And so the general comes home. Home from the war. Home to New York. And the very special place it holds in his heart. For it was here that Jean Marie Faircloth took as her husband, Douglas MacArthur, to have and to hold. A son named Arthur in the family tradition blessed the marriage. To Jean Faircloth MacArthur, her husband has always been the general, the boss. To Douglas MacArthur, she is my beloved wife and my best soldier. Together, their prayers have been for a son whose heart would be clear, whose goal would be high, so that, as parents they might say, we have not lived in vain. The general's service to his country does not end entirely with his retirement from the army. He visits with President Kennedy to discuss with him world problems and crises. And he offers his services to President Kennedy as he has given them to 10 former American presidents, beginning so long ago with William McKinley. After their informal meeting, the old soldier reveals an entirely unexpected sense of humor as he speaks of President Kennedy.
He seemed to be in excellent health and excellent spirits, and has changed little since he was one of my PT boat commanders in the Pacific War. He was a good one, too. A brave and resourceful young naval officer. Judging from the luncheon served me today, he's living higher now.
70 years and more have passed since Major Arthur MacArthur said to his wife, "I think there is the material for a soldier in that boy." Thus it began, Douglas MacArthur's journey to greatness, his lifetime of devotion to duty, honor, country, a guiding light for all who would follow him in the long gray line.
When the bells peal out their triumphant tones on Armistice Day, long years before you were born, I seem to hear the echo of the chimes of the Cadet Chapel.
when I received the solemn surrender of Japan to close victoriously the Second World War, through the stuttering words, I seemed to catch the roar of the long corps yell. When we crushed the Red at Injon, the beat of my mind kept repeating the edict of our forefathers establishing the United States Military Academy at West Point. This great tradition is now in your hands. We trust you. We have faith in you. You are our own of the long gray line.